Hi, welcome to the Imperial MBA Women's Podcast. I'm Sam Bonner, and this week we'll be discussing how COVID-19 has impacted leadership. Our guest joining us is Celia Moore, Professor of Organisational Behaviour and Co-Director of Imperial Centre for Responsible Leadership, and Leila Guerra, Vice Dean of Imperial Business School. Everyone has been impacted by COVID and the shift in human behaviour it's created. Professor Moore provides us understanding around why we're behaving like this, as well as her own ways of coping with the pandemic. And our Vice President Leila shares personal insight about what it's been like leading the university through the ongoing COVID crisis. It's worth mentioning that at the time of recording, the UK has just gone back into lockdown, and whilst a potential vaccine has been announced, there is still considerable uncertainty around going back to a more normal lifestyle. Our first guest is Professor Celia Moore. Professor, welcome to the podcast. Before we get started, can you please give our listeners a short introduction to yourself?
I'm Celia Moore, and I'm Professor of Organizational Behavior and the co-director of Imperial College Business School's Center for Responsible Leadership that is co-founded by Citibank. I have been at Imperial for a year and a half, and before that, I spent 3 years in Italy at Bocconi University in Milan and a decade at London Business School.
Within the podcast today, we're talking about how the impacts of COVID have changed people's leadership styles and how people have had to adapt to that. So I, like many people, have spent my whole career in an office-based environment. And if you told me in January, for the foreseeable future, we'd be working from home, relying on Zoom calls, and not having that day-to-day contact, I just wouldn't have believed that we'd been able to work in that same way. And because I've always been face-to-face with my team, I've built a leadership style that reflects that. And I imagine there are lots of people similar to me that have had to amend and adapt their style because their sort of face-to-face leadership style has been tested slightly over the past 8 months. Do you think there's a reason why people are generally responding to leadership differently in an online setting?
Exactly, because we're not face-to-face, right? So there's a few major differences between what it's like to interact with people face-to-face versus interact with people online. Online, we have an ability to disseminate our messages to a wider audience more quickly. But actually, a lot of leadership is dyadic and sort of analog rather than digital. So we need to find ways of adapting what came naturally to us, practiced over years of meeting in the elevator or on the stairs or in the coffee room or whatever, to planning those interactions, right? Which seems formal and is stilted, at least at first, but people need to see each other in the eye, which is another reason why I think there's a lot of technologically mediated communication that makes this hard, right? So you and I are on Zoom right now, we're looking at each other, except we're not really looking at each other. It looks like you're not looking me in the eye. It looks like you're looking a little bit farther down and to the left.
Sure.
And I don't know what it looks like for you, but we aren't actually looking at each other in the eye. And research in cognitive psychology shows that that way of interacting with other people makes it harder to establish trust because we're wired in such a way that when people aren't looking us in the eye, we trust them less, even though we're doing everything we can to develop a rapport, mm-hmm. right? So I think that there are some obstacles that we might not be really conscious of or aware of or be able to articulate, but that is what makes leading through Zoom a grind.
Absolutely, because I suppose when you're in a meeting context or that face-to-face, you can respond almost subconsciously to how like someone's body language is or maybe their tone of voice a little bit better. There isn't that delay aspect. And I suppose it will play to some people's strengths that potentially could come across very well in that sort of online setting or know exactly where their camera is. But then for other people, it will really impact maybe how they come across and engage and create those relationships purely because they don't necessarily feel as confident being recorded or they're being more conscious about what they look like on camera, potentially impacting building those relationships maybe.
So I think that teams that had a really strong basis of trust before COVID would have some leeway mm-hmm. for getting through the pandemic relatively unscathed.
Sure.
But new groups that are just coming together for the first time, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to build those bonds of trust that allow you to work together effectively, solicit diverse views and integrate them, get into discussions about how work ought to be done without it descending into conflict. Mm. All of those things require trust, and that's harder to build in a virtually mediated way.
And in researching the topic, I read a number of articles that recommended showing more of your personal side as a leader to help nurture these relationships via Zoom. And sort of also help reach out and combat that sense of alienation and potentially loneliness felt by people. So in trying to create that sort of trust element, do you agree that actually we should give more of our personal selves within our leadership styles? And as the lines between home and work blur, should we worry less about putting on that professional front with who we work with?
So I think that's a really complicated question with a lot of layers. What you're talking about really is understood as authenticity. And there are differences of opinion about the effectiveness of behaving authentically at work. It is more difficult for some people to behave authentically than others. And it also depends on what you mean by behaving authentically. So in general, there was an interesting debate that occurred over LinkedIn between Brené Brown and Adam Grant a couple of years ago, when Adam Grant posted a LinkedIn post arguing that no one wants to see who you really are. Don't be authentic at work.
Right.
And Brené Brown responded to him and said, well, I've spent my life researching this, and this is why I think that that is too general a statement. He was making an argument that if you're an asshole, you shouldn't be authentically an asshole.
Right.
What his argument was. So authenticity can mean a lot of different things, right? So revealing who you are, that can be more difficult for people who have marginalized identities or are in a house that has troubled relationships, or, you know, there's lots of reasons why it creates a vulnerability that is difficult to expose. However, I do think that if we are leaders, it's part of our job to make people feel safe, right? So we're talking right now on Zoom. You can see that I've got a mess in my background and I intentionally didn't clean it up because, you know, that's actually what my life looks like.
Sure.
And I don't use the virtual backgrounds unless I'm giving a webinar to hundreds of people. But if I'm ever doing anything sort of dyadically or in small groups, I will never have a virtual background because I want people to see that I, you know, this is the way I live and my five-year-old will wander in. And all of that will, I think, helps humanize us, right? That said, I think we need to be respectful of what other people's boundaries are. Right? So other people are going to feel less safe revealing as much online. And those blurred boundaries are more problematic for some people than others. But I think one of the sort of silver linings of this pandemic has been for people to really recognize all the constraints that other people are operating under, right? With kids coming in and out or, you know, whatever that is.
No, I agree. And I think the children running and out the room has got to be one of my favorite sort of silver linings from the pandemic, because there was that very famous case of a gentleman being interviewed on the BBC at home and his child ran into the room and it went viral. Everyone thought it was hilarious because it was breaking a boundary that previously, you know, it couldn't be blurred because we all were at work and it was unusual to have that context. You know, now we're here in this situation and people running in and being kissed on the cheek by their child, or the more entrepreneurial children knowing that that's the time to go in and bargain for food or treats or
yes.
something whilst, you know, mum's on the screen with 30 of her colleagues is one of the joys. And it definitely brings that more personal touch to an insight into what people's lives are really like, I suppose. So this sort of leads me on to my third question, which is around responsible leadership, which is inspired by the article that you wrote recently, and this sort of disintegration of long-termism. So with so many variables that are affecting our working lives, or, you know, just our lives in general at the moment, and in the short term as well, they're feeling a little hysterical. So the US election results, the responses of people going back into lockdown, employees being furloughed or being laid off in large numbers. Also Brexit in the background coming through and what the impact that is going to have on our economy and on how we work in the UK. How can leaders or managers authentically talk about sort of anything in the long term? If anything, to help with like stability, making people feel secure in their workplace, or even the mental health of people. So we can try and focus on life after this sort of short-term disruption of 2020, because we will sort of come past this and move forward eventually.
Yeah. Well, one of my mantras for getting through this year has been that all pandemics end, right? And if I get really overwhelmed, I just start repeating that to myself in my head, because it can be hard to imagine that on some days. Mm. I don't think that thinking about the long term is at odds with thinking about the short term. I think that right now there are some things that need to be taken care of in the immediate term, mm-hmm. right? Governments are spending a lot of money propping up the economy. We will need to deal with that in the long term.
Yeah.
But right now, we need to make sure that the hospitals aren't overrun. So there are certain periods in history where you really do need to think about how do we get through the immediate term. Mm. My general point as co-director of the Center for Responsible Leadership in terms of thinking about the long term is that strategic planning needs to take more into account what will happen in the longer term, or else we won't have a universe left to function in or earn profits in, you know. So I think that's a mindset that can be practiced, mm-hmm. probably less so this year than in other years.
So just to round our questions up, I just wondered from your perspective, has there been any particular styles of leadership or examples that you've seen this year that's been successful in the way that they've dealt with COVID, that they've led in a particular style, or any key recommendations that you would give to our listeners to act on?
So for me, the big one is to try and make our working lives as connected and human as possible, right? So because we can't do any of those informal check-ins, we need to create that space. So on a couple different occasions during the last few months, I've had people who I'm only sort of distally connected to and not managed by just checking with me mm-hmm. by either email or giving me a call or WhatsApp. And it has meant so much just to be noticed, right? Yeah. So I think the other thing that is the good practice is to notice. People all want to be seen and heard and respected, right? So when we're in those meetings, acknowledge that you're seeing someone. Tell someone that you really like the mug they're drinking out of, or that their cat is especially cute, or you really like how their bookshelves are set up, or find ways of allowing people to feel seen, mm-hmm. because I think that that's really what we're craving this year, is that humanity. And as wonderful as technologically mediated communication is, it does not replace what we have lost and are grieving this year. So any way we can find to restore even a tiny bit of that, I think is best leadership practice.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. And I look forward to future conversations.
Thanks so much, Sam. Have a great day.
Our second guest today is Imperial's Vice Dean, Leila Guerra. I caught up with her to discuss work-life balance in times of crisis, the perils of mass Zoom calls, and the silver linings that have emerged from the pandemic. Hi, Leila. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now, all the Imperial students will, of course, know who you are, but it would be fantastic just to kick us off if you give us a little bit of background around what you do, what your career's been, and your role at Imperial.
Thank you so much, Sam. And it's such a pleasure and a privilege for me to be here with you today. Thank you for the invitation. As you know, I'm the Vice Dean of Education for the Business School. That means I manage all the programs, most of the teams, and work together with the dean to also develop the strategy and the long-term plans for the Business School. And we work alongside the college, of course. I've been at Imperial now for almost 3 years, and was before that at Singapore Management University in Singapore, where I had a similar role. And I've also worked at London Business School and at IE Business School in Madrid. So you can see I spent quite a while now in higher education, and I ended up in higher education after I studied my executive MBA at IE. Before that, I had a very different career. I was working in business development and private companies. But after I finished my MBA, the school asked me to stay, and that defined my future steps. And here we are.
So you've already experienced a big change in your career, you could say. But 2020 has almost seen the ultimate challenge, and maybe more so in crisis management with COVID. Obviously, you have a lot of experience working within academic institutions. And I think it's fair to say, we're not being too mean, that they take their time considering the processes they apply to implementing decisions to ensure that as many members feel the benefits as possible. So what changes had to be made to enable the business school leadership to turn around and make decisions as fast as you did when it came to COVID? And what were your feelings around those changes? Like, did you have any concerns?
That's a brilliant question. First of all, you're very, very right. Higher education and business schools tend to be sometimes slow in making decisions. And it's because, of course, the impact we have and the ambitions we have for all of our students and our community, and also the outcomes from our research. But we also tend to be quite quick when there are some things that we want to have very, very quickly introduced into our curriculum or into our community, or when students ask something. So I always tell my teams, and this was before COVID-19, that we have to prepare ourselves to be running a marathon at the same time we're running a sprint. And it's finding the balance between what things you have to put on the sprint and what things that you know will have to work on the marathon that actually gives you that successful combination. Now, obviously, then March came along, March 2020, and we suddenly saw our ground disappearing, and every single thing we had been doing was suddenly questioned or was suddenly in jeopardy. And most importantly, we were also suffering for our students and were suffering for our community because of that huge uncertainty that everybody had around their jobs, their personal lives, their health and safety. And so I actually remember that day, 13th of March, sitting there and saying, oh my God, we have to do something now. At that time, the machine, if I can call it that way, just got into motion, and we started very quickly to do operational changes that we kind of already had in place. So Imperial was in a very lucky place because we had invested in a tech, we had invested in technology. So we had the tools ahead of us, and we knew what we had to activate to do the operational changes. We also suddenly were thinking about leadership changes. And the most important one for me was to make sure that my voice and my message came across to every single member of our community, and that we could, or I could, in a very humble way and with my little impact, make sure that everybody knew that we had their backs and that we had a plan and that we could help them through this in various ways. And that leadership change went through communication. The most important thing in my head, I remember, was thinking, we just need to communicate over and over again. We're here for you. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing things. Make sure that that was available to everybody. And we were obviously working towards the students, which is our main stakeholders and the ones that I felt most protected about. I would need to protect my students. But I also was thinking about the teams who were being asked to work over and over hours to make sure we could deliver, while they were also worrying about what was happening in their homes, what was happening with the job uncertainty, etc. So it was operational changes, leadership changes, and then it was also about managing everybody's concerns. And it's fair to say we didn't have a lot of time to think. And it was many of the things that I implemented were, okay, I know this, I have experience, I've worked in higher education. This is not the first crisis. It's potentially fair to say, at least for me, it's the biggest crisis we've all lived in our generation.
Absolutely.
But we had the tools. We just had to implement them and making sure we didn't leave anyone behind. And then it was also about knowing what was right for us. Who are we as a community? And I think it's fair to say that the community was responding so well and so supportive to each other, and that reinforced the early decisions we were taking. And it was all about protecting each other and making sure that we got all through this together. To give you an example, I one of the things that touched my heart during those first weeks of the crisis and how we changed as a community was this EMBA student who wrote to me, and he told me, I understand everything you're doing and I appreciate that, but you have to protect the undergraduates of the Faculty of Medicine. They're out there. They are really the ones who are fighting this pandemic, and you're making them take exams and you're making them do that. And this EMBA student was challenging us on some of the decisions, not for themselves or for their cohort, but for the undergraduate students of another faculty. And I found that such a great way of reminding us on how we as a community could stand this together and go through it.
No, definitely. And one of the things that's really struck me this year is that whilst we sort of took for granted being able to be face to face, especially for a majority of the students at Imperial, but in our professional lives and our personal lives, actually going through something like this together does also pull together a community a lot as well, even though we can't be physically together, if that makes sense. And it sort of creates closer networks or opportunities for relationships that might have been overlooked in sort of normal times, if we can still call that. But it sounds like you guys had obviously forecast and planned in advance for some crisis, and you were able to put things into place. But that must have had an impact on your personal leadership. And you're saying you were going out and that communication all the times. And was there something that you had to adapt to enable yourself to do it? Or were there sort of practices that you already had in your sort of your portfolio, if you like, that you could expand on and share with other people to help them lead better in this time of crisis?
I think it's a very interesting question. It was a combination of both. When I look back to the leadership skills that I had been taught in the degrees that I had studied or in the jobs that I had had, there were certainly skills there that I knew, okay, this is a time to bring them out. And it linked back to being someone people could trust, being very stable in our way, in my way of communicating, knowing that I had to listen very carefully to make sure, as I said, that I wasn't leaving anyone behind, and also adapting my style to a very different environment. I'm a person that loves the human connections and loves to talk to people and listen to people. And I do that by just walking on the corridors and meeting casually and doing a joke here. And then you suddenly build that connection and you created this relationship. And that was gone. And suddenly I was addressing students via Zoom, and I could not read the room. I could not read the energy. And that's where all of the leadership skills that I might have acquired in my career were suddenly not as effective, because I draw many of them from reading that energy levels and reading the students as they speak to me. It was just very, very complicated to do that in a flat screen where I had maybe 27 in front of me and many others that I could not see because they had their videos out. So I wasn't sure if the message was landing, if I was connecting. So one of the big learning exercises for me was to adapt my leadership style to this Zoom world and try to find other ways of connecting, which now, by the way, I do most of the times with chatting. So the chat exercise to me is very helpful to build little connections with people who are in the room when I can't see them or they're not engaging with us. So I make sure that I can find a way of chatting privately or in an open forum so that there is still the informality. I think my Mediterranean style comes across as well. I like to think that I'm not too formal, and that's something that I have learned to be very comfortable with. At the early parts of my career, people would tell me, oh, Leila, particularly as a woman, you should be friendly, or you shouldn't smile so much, or you should not be creating that personal connections with people, sharing your stories and all of that. At that time, I questioned that and said, should I change? And I actually remember one particular moment when I moved to the UK where I actually tried actively to change my style.
Really?
I know. I tried to be vain.
I think lots of people would definitely be able to relate to this. And if maybe it's like a British like culture, like holding back or sort of having a different face at work.
Yes,
but that's interesting
yes.
that you actually tried to adopt it as well.
I tried to be very British. I did. I felt that's what I had to do. I was like, I'm now in a senior position and I need to adapt. And I remember very clearly one of my best friends who's a psychologist called me and said, Leila, but don't you realize they hired you for who you are, not for who you think they want? And that was a key breakthrough moment for me about this is actually right. They've hired me for who I am, and I am the way I am. So, and then since then, I've said, this is my style, and this is how I am, and I want you to know me. And I want to be true. I want you to be aware that this is my true me, that I'm the same at home that I'm with you. And I had to adapt that when we then had this whole Zoom world. But it was not that difficult. I think it was much harder for me when I was in this situation of trying to be something I wasn't.
We're kind of slightly losing that way to relate to each other, maybe through body language or picking up the tone or how we're interacting with each other, like you're saying, through the room and through Zoom. But then also people are looking for answers, and we're kind of maybe more emotionally reliant on, especially our leaders, to give us insight or clarity about what's happening and moving forward. And I think it's quite easy when we look to leaders to forget that they have their own concerns and pressures, especially in time of crisis. So you've already spoken how you're very open and you engage with people, but how did you manage the huge demands of work, giving so much of yourself, and then also the concerns around your family, which would have been a very natural response, especially in March when the situation for everyone was changing on a daily, if not an hourly basis?
So I promised I would be open, so I'll share how it was. To be honest, in March, it was all about work for me. I was only worried about work, and I knew that my kids were fine and my husband was fine. Amazingly, they also understood that this was a time for them to let mommy focus on her community, because if you, and you know me, it's this is not a work for me. This is my passion. This is my commitment. This is my hobby. As my husband once told me, your job is not only your work; it's also your hobby, because you spend all your day thinking of it. And what happened there is, I think in a family, usually there's a balance when someone of the family needs more of the others, and that's a moment to step in. And my little family at home realized that they had to help me there and step in and make sure that I could just focus on one thing, because I literally didn't have the bandwidth to focus on anything else. I've never worked as hard. I promise, every time I think about in the past when I'd say, no, we're working really hard, this is the last 6 months, I've only worked. It was 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, everybody in the community just squeezing our brains out about what we had to do. We were kind of in survival mode about, we have to go through this. And my family responded to that request of me that I hadn't even formulated. I am very lucky. I have a husband who is a stay-at-home dad. He's a freelancer, but he could adapt his work, basically deprioritize it completely so that he could focus on our kids. They're very young. They're 7 and 9. And so they got to see a little bit less of their mom during that period. And then what also happened is that I learned to understand that I also wasn't alone in this. And I'm not always the best in delegating. And I understood, and that's, I think, one of the biggest learning exercises for me, that we were all of us not alone, that the dean, myself, we're not alone in this. And I mentioned to some of the student leaders were absolutely brilliant and amazing in helping us through the situation. Personally, for me, it was a challenging time. I usually don't talk about it, but that actually meant that work became also a way of focusing completely on something that I could manage and that I could control and I could do something about it and leave that grief that I was experiencing slightly, not aside, but slightly less attended for a good reason or not, depending on how you see it. But it did help me. And the 6 months around it were a way for me also to process that, because I actually lost my mom in February.
First, I want to offer my deepest condolences to you and your family. And I know the hearts of those listening will go out to you. I think it takes a lot of strength to share such personal experiences openly like that. Have you found that sharing more of your personal experiences as a leader has been beneficial to help relationships and a sense of connection with colleagues and students?
What it also allowed me to do is to open up myself, be more empathetic and be more accessible to students and to faculty. And I did get that back. Every time I had someone telling me, I found a job, my family's fine, I am learning so much from the elective, or I really love multimode, which we have a lot of students telling us that, or I have a faculty member telling us, I thought I would never be able to teach online and now I can, or thank you so much for your help with this situation. Every time I get that feedback, I reinforce myself in this is it. This is my small contribution to the world or to my world, and I can see that reflected back. I think bit to your question as well, and the reason I wanted to share my personal story, this Zoom world we're now in has allowed us to be more human. And I did have a lot of staff members telling us, particularly the first weeks when their mental balance and the challenges and the stress was very, very high, they really appreciated seeing the dean. You know, he's the dean, he's our main leader, mm-hmm. and seeing him at home, interrupted by his kids, balancing and struggling with the work-life balance, and suddenly having the noises from the street coming outside, and suddenly being clear that we're all in the same situation, and that we all have our own personal circumstances and our own struggles, and that we overcome them. I think that made it very human, and that got a lot of people, I had many of my staff members telling me, that made it for me. Being the dean and you, human, you know, you might get my kids suddenly knocking on the door and that's it. We're just all here together.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a nice way to end this segment on, is that whilst Corona might have tried to separate us all, actually, it's brought together whole networks. And we are, like you said, we're in it together. Leila, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam. Thank you again for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Thanks to both our guests this week, and I hope you've enjoyed today's discussion. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts, or your preferred platform. We'll be back in 2 weeks, and if you want to get in touch, search for the Imperial MBA Women's Group on LinkedIn or Instagram.